My name is Kenyon Farrow, and I'm in Brooklyn, New York City, where I've lived for the last 12 years for the most part. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, and I've also lived in New Orleans, Louisiana for a time. And what I'm doing right now, I've worked for the last 5 years in different capacities with an organization called Queers for Economic Justice. And Queers for Economic Justice, or QEJ, does community organizing, advocacy, research, leadership development work on economic justice issues that impact the LGBT community here in the U.S. A lot of what you often see in terms of the gay and lesbian community in the U.S. reflects a lot of wealthy, often white gay men and lesbians, right? The Ellen DeGeneres of the world, the, you know, kind of Will and Grace, those kind of TV shows or whatever. But we often don't see a lot about poor, homeless, working class, you know, low income LGBT folks in the U.S. and especially people of color. And so our organization does kind of work on those issues that impact that aspect of our community. Other than that, I've also been involved in HIV/AIDS prevention work for a number of years. Have also done a lot of organizing work around the prison system in the U.S. And around homophobic violence and such. So doing organizing and also, you know, kind of writing and editing is also part of my work as well.
Maybe we could start with speaking more in depth about Queers for Economic Justice. When was this organization founded?
Sure. So Queers for Economic Justice was founded about 10 years ago, and it was founded by a group of advocates and activists, folks who around 1999 saw that the sort of LGBT, the mainstream LGBT movement was moving more and more to the right in terms of its politics, and at the same time seeing more and more poor LGBT folks here in New York City showing up in welfare offices, showing up in the shelter system, and having particular kinds of challenges. And so QEJ was initially the Queers for Economic Justice Network, so it wasn't an official kind of nonprofit or NGO we might think of it, but was really just a kind of network of people and organizations that were trying to figure out how to do work and advocate on behalf of low-income and homeless LGBT and queer folks here in New York City. And because of that, it was a really sort of unique organization, and a lot of the initial founders, including Joseph DeFilippis, who was the founding executive director, found that trying to get a lot of the work done in a sort of network, a coalition, everybody had to go back home to their, you know, original organizations and, you know, to get by and to make certain kinds of decisions. So at that point, they decided to become an organization. And so the organization was sort of officially incorporated in 2002. So the organization, you know, has been sort of an official nonprofit for about 8 years. And so that was sort of the initial founding. Starting out, the organization worked on homelessness and welfare as its primary issues. A lot of people don't think about kind of welfare and public assistance in the U.S. and how it impacts low-income LGBT folks. In 1997, the federal government passed the Welfare Reform Act, which basically ended you know, public assistance and welfare as we once knew it. And part of that policy change created a situation where there was more money being put into marriage promotion for low-income women in order to get their public assistance benefits to take care of their children, and also forcing women to have to identify biological fathers on birth certificates in order to get those benefits as well. And if you're a lesbian with children and you have kids and maybe either don't have contact with the father anymore, or you had a baby in an arrangement where it was understood that that man was not going to be a primary caretaker of that child, naming him on a birth certificate so that the state could go after him for child support payments didn't make any sense. And so they found themselves in a sort of catch-22. So the QEJ was really kind of formed because of some of those issues. And then because it was such a unique sort of voice in the world, it ended up kind of having more national reach as an organization because there were so few organizations working specifically on, homelessness and, welfare and those kinds of issues as they pertain to LGBT people.
There's something striking about the name of the organization that I would like you to elaborate on, because it could very well be called LGBT for Equality.
Right.
But it's called Queers for Economic Justice, which I think are operatively two very interesting distinctions, to identify as queer as opposed to LGBT.
Right.
And to demand economic justice as opposed to equality.
Right.
Can you speak about that? I mean, how does the organization position itself theoretically, if you will, or ideologically?
So the name Queers for Economic Justice was chosen very intentionally because the founders wanted to make sure that we were talking about, in terms of queer, a kind of queer politics and a queer political lens versus an LGBT lens, right? So people sometimes use the term queer to partly be all-encompassing of different, sexual orientation and also different gender identities, so to use sort of one without using the whole alphabet. But then it's also about actually naming that what we see as the kind of lesbian and gay rights movement in and of itself is a project that's about assimilating into what already exists in terms of, very, well-fed and well-scrubbed middle-class sort of bourgeois, class values and very white values. And the term queer being a politic that actually values the kind of different ways in which the community is gendered, the different ways in which the community has, is made up of different people of color who use a range of other sort of terms that aren't necessarily just sort of gay and lesbian terms. And also to say that it's actually okay to be deviant, if you will, and that you don't have to sort of assimilate into a more kind of normal model in order to be accepted. So that's one on the queer and in the economic justice and why that was chosen versus economic, empowerment or or economic equality or something of that nature, is because QEJ really has an anti-capitalist and a socialist kind of lens to how it sees economic justice. So we're not talking about ways in which to just kind of assimilate, poor, low-income or queer people into the kind of dominant capitalist system or framework. We're talking about wealth redistribution largely, right? And even though we sometimes in our local work are working very specifically on policies that impact low-income LGBT people to sort of make their conditions, having to negotiate some of these systems that poor people have to negotiate better and serve them better, but we also understand that it's also morally objectionable that people are poor, right, in a country that has so much wealth, right, and that we understand that poverty is actually systemic and institutionalized and not just about, getting people, training to get access to better jobs or about education or whatever. We understand it in a situation where, the labor movement has been, pretty much gutted in a lot of ways, by the right. What we're seeing in Wisconsin, right, matters to us in terms of public workers losing or threatening to have their benefits cut and their right to even collectively bargain be undermined. We see that as queer issues, right? And that those things are central to how we see the world and isn't just about getting people access to, you know, the existing kind of economic framework.
Is there a precedent organization that you guys were looking at in terms of modeling a plan of action and strategies? Because it seems like the discourse that you are exposing to me right now was very much in the agenda in the late 1970s, for example, or even early 1970s. But it is in extinction nowadays. To speak of economic justice in this country is something that is not at high priority in any most organizations' agendas. Where do you come from?
Well, I think that the founders of Queer Speak Economic Justice, I think, come from some of them are older activists who actually come from, you know, the kind of left of the 60s and 70s, right? Amber Hollabaugh, for instance, who is the current interim executive director and a good friend of mine, I mean, was a civil rights, you know, organizer and tried to join SNCC when she was very young, when she was too young, and so they kicked her out, and then did a lot of other kinds of radical work and then moved into the kind of queer liberation movement once that began to formulate in the early 70s. And a lot of that work was leftist work, right, in a kind of queer context, but, you know, was not a sort of project of assimilation. And then people who, you know, also came, you know, in the 80s through the more radical formations of, you know, the AIDS movement as well. We have, so a lot of our folks come from those trajectories. And so that shaped how QEJ sort of politically was situated. As opposed to, you know, becoming a kind of equality or economic opportunity kind of organization.
How is Queers for Economic Justice funded?
So QEJ is largely funded by private foundations and also by individual donors. And it's a challenge because, you know, our name is Queers for Economic Justice, right? And so there's not even a lot of funders, even in the progressive world, who understand what that means, understand what we do, or even support what we do and think about the world and how it functions. And this is particularly true of a lot of the kind of LGBT funders. We have struggled for years to, in order to just fund the work that we do, articulate why economic justice issues matter to queer people. And then also how we actually do the work matters so that it's not just an organization where, you know, we're just a bunch of people advocating on an issue that don't have any connection to a larger base, that isn't kind of intimately involved in the community that we work in folks' lives in a particular way. And so that kind of organizing strategy and work is takes longer, right, in some respects to do. And it's not just, we're not just an organization that's just going to write a sort of a bunch of policy papers and do sort of legislative advocacy in absence of actually being able to also kind of organize and do leadership development amongst a base, right? And so that work then looks really different from larger organizations with more resources that, you know, their connection to a quote unquote base is just their email list or just the people that, you know, write them $25 or $50 a year to become quote unquote members, right? You know, we want people to write us those checks too and larger ones, but that's not how we sort of see membership broadly. We see it in a much more direct relationship way, and that has to influence how any kind of political work that we do has to be from that standpoint. So it's a challenge with a lot of funders in an increasing situation where, you know, philanthropy is concerned with measurable goals and measurable outcomes, and those sort of like kind of nonprofit but corporate at the same time lingo for how, you know, work should happen and how you can sort of measure specific kinds of social change, which I think is a lot of bunk.
It also seems to me like that the mission of Queers for Economic Justice is completely opposed to the kind of mainstream LGBT agenda, focusing on marriage equality, don't ask, don't tell, the hate anti-hate crime discrimination bill, and so on and so forth. You seem to be concerned with a very different type of issues that are not trying to represent a community in singular, but rather perhaps communities in plural.
Right. I think QEJ is actually oppositionally opposed to the kind of mainstream, what I call the sort of four pillar issues of the mainstream LGBT movement in the U.S. So marriage equality, don't ask, don't tell, or the dropping of the military ban that's often referred to as don't ask, don't tell, and hate crimes inclusion. And then the fourth being, you know, employment non-discrimination, right? So, so for us, I mean, we see those four issues. This, first of all, marriage equality being an issue that primarily benefits upper class, wealthy, often white gays and lesbians who have property and other sorts of those kind of things to sort of pass on to people, right? Or who have health insurance that they want to give their partner. But if you're poor, queer, with no health insurance or no job to speak of, and certainly no property to speak of, marriage as the singular issue and the way that it's framed that is going to be the sort of panacea for all that, you know, ills the sort of LGBT community, that's not going to work so well for you, right? And certainly we know many poor straight people who are married for whom marriage did not bring about any major kind of economic shifts. And we also see the kind of marriage equality movement very much tied to a kind of a conservative and a neoconservative agenda around privatization so that the state itself can, take less responsibility for helping people through different kinds of social safety net programs, and that everybody's supposed to be married in their little kind of household, and all of your sort of social and economic needs are supposed to be taken care of there, and the state owes you nothing. And that's what we're seeing in Wisconsin with the pension debate, right, and with the public workers debate. Is the kind of neoconservative movement advancing that agenda right now. So we're opposed to marriage on those standpoint. We're opposed to the ban, to dropping the ban on gays in the military, advocating for gay inclusion in the military because of the impact of the military-industrial complex on, first of all, the U.S. just sort of budget, so that about half of the U.S. budget comes down to military spending in some way, shape, or form. And if we cut back major portions of that, how much money would be available to help people with health care and a range of other sort of needs? But also what the military and the U.S. sort of war machine does in other places, right? So, you know, I often say to people that if you want to support the human rights of gays and lesbians in the U.S., then it doesn't make any sense to support, you know, the U.S. military to go be able and kill and maim and destroy gays and lesbians in Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, undercover, or a range of other places where the U.S. is doing all kinds of imperialist kinds of military operations, you know. And you know, similarly with hate crimes in terms of expanding the prison system in the U.S., which is already the largest that the world has ever seen in human civilization, and primarily impacts, people of color, including queer people who are locked up. And that, you know, the Employee Non-Discrimination Act itself is not a real plan towards economic justice. It's not talking about livable wages. It's not talking about, economic sustainability. It's merely just a plan for people who have work to be able to figure out some legal system for filing discrimination cases, which the ones that actually win, even based on what we have in terms of race or religion or, you know, gender or what have you, are few and far between, like actually being able to prove that those things actually occurred and existed. So we are opposed in a large extent to the kind of mainstream movement.
I read yesterday a release that you wrote after Don't Ask, Don't Tell recently, in which you're speaking about the offering of jobs in the military to people and how people think of this as an opportunity. Can you speak of that?
Sure. What I've often had people say to me when I tell them that, you know, myself and QEJ as an organization opposes the lifting of the, you know, don't ask, don't tell ban, they say, well, you're an economic justice organization. And Kenyon, don't you think that, you know, lots of poor and working class LGBT folks who, you know, need access to jobs, you know, really rely on the military for access to those jobs and to get out of poverty or, you know, to get, you know, the kind of money for education once they serve and what have you. And my response is, yes, I understand that people do that for a lot of those reasons. However, I think that it is, it's immoral that the U.S.'s largest federal jobs program is the military, first and foremost. That's just an absurd reality. And therefore, to me, that isn't solving the problem. And certainly when we consider being in, you know, several sort of wars as we are right now, the number of soldiers who come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, that come back with physical disabilities, that the pervasiveness of rape and sexual assault in the military, particularly targeting women, but we don't know data around how many of those women are targeted because they're queer, perceived to be, how many men are targeted for sexual assault and rape because they are perceived to be queer. So I'm looking at just like kind of the myriad of ways that even for people in the military, that their lives are devastated, actually, and that actually the material conditions of serving in the military create poverty, right? And the numbers of homeless veterans, the, you know, again, the numbers of people who come back with various kinds of disabilities as, you know, caused by their military service. Needless to say, again, of the specific kind of acts of violence that the military perpetuates in different places around the world, and which, you know, I think, and some other people have said, actually, particularly in the case of the Middle East right now, have actually fueled, you know, kind of fundamentalist / nationalist backlashes for which queer people become targeted under those conditions, you know, in places like, and which is really happening in Iraq right now. So, you know, so to me, the idea that the military is kind of an answer to an economic justice question is really a shallow answer.
It seems to me that the strength of the organization is this idea of working very closely with the communities and creating some kind of educational programs and self-empowerment and a positive self-perception, if you will. Can you speak, for example, about the situation of homeless queers in New York?
Sure.
Or in the U.S.? What is happening there, and how are you guys approaching this question?
In the United States, we have homeless queer population that is nothing short of a national crisis. When you look at New York City, we certainly know that among queer LGBT youth, conservative numbers say 30%. Other numbers say half of all homeless youth in New York City identify as LGBT or queer youth. When you look at the national numbers, they're very similar. They're about 20% on the low end to 40% on the high end of homeless youth in the U.S. identify as queer youth. That is not a part of any of the national kind of LGBT movement conversation right now, despite to me that those numbers suggest an actual crisis. So one of the challenges or what we do at QEJ in respect to homelessness is one, that we work specifically in the adult shelter system in New York City. The only data that we have about LGBT homelessness is youth, so we have to use it. But we also, feel like one of the things that sort of happens in the U.S. in the LGBT movement is people will give lip service to, you know, the crisis of LGBT youth homelessness. No funding is really, you know, coming down to fund major efforts to stem it. But it seems to be this disconnect that people think that, okay, so there's people who are homeless at 16, but somehow they are, you know, in graduate, you know, MBA programs at Harvard at 25. And that's just not the reality, or that they're somehow, you know, able to pull themselves out of poverty once they reach adulthood, which just isn't true. If you're homeless at 18, you're likely to be homeless at 25, or to have various kinds of housing instability throughout your life, you know, that, you know, was about when you started out being homeless. So what we do is, one is that we train a team of facilitators who run sort of support groups in the actual shelter system in New York City, in the adult shelter system, which are people 18 and over. And we, in addition to doing those sort of trainings, or train the trainers to do the work in the shelter systems, they provide an actual just sort of place of support, because being homeless, you know, you are so far removed, one, from just generally being able to participate in certain kinds of places and institutions in society, but also being queer, because so much of the kind of LGBT infrastructure that exists is based in places of commerce, right? So bars and clubs, you know, gay coffee shops, bookshops, restaurants, whatever, that we've seen over the last 10 or 15 years become increasingly target people who aren't in those places buying things, right? So I've been in gay coffee shops where queer kids, mostly Black and Latino kids, are there hanging out. And if they aren't seen to be, you know, buying something at that moment, they have been kicked out. So because of that, folks get kind of, you know, marginalized. And so actually being in the shelter itself provides a space to sort of have folks build some level of community and support within the shelter. Then we're also able to help folks connect to different kinds of services and certain kinds of advocacy, so that they can either get out of the shelter system and get housing, or get access to the kind of welfare and public assistance benefits that will help kind of stabilize their incomes. And then third, to also begin to organize those folks to be able to challenge the actual shelter themselves. And sometimes it's based on issues that are relevant to all homeless people, whether it's around conditions in that shelter, or you know, food, and you know, how terrible it is in the shelter system, security guards targeting queer folks or other folks in the shelter. So we do a lot of that sort of work as well. And then also kind of, you know, have embarked upon a couple sort of citywide campaigns around the shelter system itself. So that's a lot of kind of what we do. And recently I've been kind of reading different stories around the country. One just recently happened in Georgia where queer folks were kicked out of a shelter in the state of Georgia. We get calls all the time from people all around the country, because we're, as small as we are, one of the few places that people have kind of either Googled or found us doing stuff around queer homelessness, asking us to help them figure out how to sort of organize and do the advocacy pieces in their cities. And so we're increasingly looking at ways to actually begin to kind of help different cities or different other places, organizations or groups of folks kind of take up work around kind of queer homelessness in their cities and begin to move it. But that's, you know, we're sort of in the early stages of that.
Are those layers of discrimination both from the shelter system itself and from the other homeless people against queer people in the shelter?
Yeah, the discrimination of queer homeless folks in the shelter system is from a myriad of places. It's both from the kind of staff and the institution, the shelter, you know, itself. We also see it, within, you know, kind of interpersonal interactions with other homeless people in the shelter system. And even sometimes discrimination and targeting by queer folks against trans folks in the shelter system, right? you know, we've seen a range. And so some of what we've actually had to do is to help kind of being in the shelters and kind of helping to sort of build that community and do sort of work there has actually helped actually decrease some of the tensions between, you know, queer women or lesbians and trans women in the same shelter, right? Like we've seen a number of those things or, you know, certainly even with, you know, kind of straight folks in the shelter system against other, you know, targeting queer folks, you know, we've done work because we keep our groups actually open to anybody in the shelter who wants to come. We explain that this is the shelter's obvious. This is kind of a queer specific sort of, this is the stuff we're going to be talking about. And what we found is that actually some of the folks who come to those are straight folks who have, sometimes they have queer kids that they have been out of touch with because of their homophobia for years, queer siblings that they've been out of touch with. And so they come sometimes to the space to kind of work through their own stuff around their own kind of homophobia and transphobia. And that's actually been kind of another sort of byproduct of actually doing that work in the shelters itself.
I'm aware that recently Queers for Economic Justice managed to arbiter the fact that trans people can choose what shelter to go to. How was the situation before, and how has this changed the life of trans people?
Sure. So, several years ago, the situation for trans people in trying to access the New York City shelter system was pretty intense, and it still is in many ways. But several years ago, if you were a trans person and you signed up to, you know, to try to get access to the shelter system, and you went to, you know, the intake, and it was up to the person sitting at intake to decide for you whether you belonged in the men's or the women's shelter, despite what you said, despite what your documentation said about, even if you were able to get your, you know, birth certificate or other sort of IDs changed, if they saw you and perceived you to not be the gender that you stated, they could tell you where to go.
Based on their biology and their...
Based on their biology. They would make whatever determination, and you had to go or not get shelter that night. What QEJ did in conjunction with a few other organizations was to advocate within the Department of Homeless Services for trans people to be able to self-identify what shelter they felt most comfortable in, despite what their documentation said. So if they weren't able to get their documents changed to match their, you know, current gender identity, or to not also make it based on whether or not somebody's had a number of surgeries, right, to begin their kind of physical transition, that the policy was written in such a way to any person who identified as transgender, genderqueer, a range of different sort of terms, could access whatever shelter they felt most comfortable in. So that is actually... in many ways benefited a lot of trans folks in the shelter system. Now, we still come up across a situation where shelters will tell trans people that they don't take trans people at that shelter, which is a lie. In New York City, you know, you have to take people in the shelter system if there are beds, right? There's no like, this shelter can't say, if it's a men's shelter and there's a queer person or a trans man or whatever, they can't say, oh, there's no, we don't take your kind here or whatever. Like you have to. But what we've been able to do is build enough relationships with shelters, particularly women's shelters that are, and we've done a lot of work in to make sort of more queer friendly within the shelter system itself. People often refer queer and trans folks to those shelters because they'll take the, you know, they'll be more safe in those shelters because the staff has better training and is more queer friendly in some cases. So that's kind of how the policy has helped you know, trans folks in terms of getting access to shelter in New York City, but there's still a long way to go.
Is the situation in the prison system similar in many ways?
The situation in the prison system in the U.S. and trans folks is very similar to the shelter system, in the sense that off in most places, if you're trans identified, you have to go to whatever shelter your biological, whatever your birth certificate says, basically, like whatever
to
your
prison.
Oh, I'm sorry, to prison, right? You have to go to whatever gender prison your sort of biological documentation or whatever genitalia you have, you're going to be assigned in one place or the other. Some places have, within prisons, they have sort of queer specific wings of the prison, or oftentimes what happens is that queer or trans folks are put in protective custody, which is really solitary confinement. It's not as though there's a separate place in the prisons where they place, you know, queer people. They usually, in order to supposedly keep them safe from various kinds of violence or sexual assault or rape within the prison, they'll put you in quote-unquote protective custody, which is the exact same thing as solitary confinement, which is basically 23 hours a day lockdown. You can go outside, but usually if you're in protective custody, quote-unquote, or solitary confinement, your 1 hour spent outside, you know, on the yard, you're in an actual cage. So you don't, it's not like you're out on the in the open space with the other prisoners. You're in a little, maybe 12-foot cage that you have to exercise or do whatever you're going to do in that cage to keep you protected. So there's no actual, so it's not like you're in a better situation. And so many, you know, queer and trans folks, even if they've been targeted for or have experienced certain kinds of violence or rape in prisons, will elect to be in with the general population, because who wants to be in solitary confinement? Nobody. So it almost is better to kind of try to figure out how to negotiate or manage being in the facility.
They're giving a choice?
In general pop. Sometimes they are. Sometimes people try to advocate to be, sometimes folks have advocated to be removed from general population, and then when they find out they're actually in solitary confinement, they then try to get back, and that's another sort of challenge, is, you know, trying to get back into general population. Sometimes they're successful in getting back into general population, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes, you know, depends on the warden or who the guards are, who say, well, you said you wanted to be here, or we can't have you in general pop because you cause all kinds of problems, right? Which, you know, basically means like you're targeted in all these different ways. So they'll keep you in solitary as long as they can.
So what kind of work can be done to improve the lives of people in prisons systems?
I think what the best thing to be done to improve, you know, the lives of prisoners, I think, is to imprison less people. You know, in the U.S., we are 5% of the world's total population, and we have 25% of the world's prisoners, right? 2.3 million prisoners at this point. That does not include jails or people under other kinds of house arrest, parole, probation, right? Which totals like 7.5 million people. But if we look at prisons themselves, so we're also talking about half of those people are people of African descent. And 70% of them, of prisoners in the U.S. are people of color, right, in general. So I think the best thing to be done in terms of the prison situation is to actually end, you know, mandatory minimum sentencing, you know, end the war on drugs, to decriminalize drug use and possession in the U.S., and I would say the kind of front end things that lead to many folks, more than half the prison population currently is in there for petty drug offenses, primarily, just like in those policies, and we'll have less folks going to prison to begin with.
What is the relationship between HIV transmission and prevention work and the prison system? What kind of work is done in that regard?
Sure, so in terms of HIV transmission in the prison system, it's really a patchwork across the U.S. The city jails do one thing in different places, right? And then the prisons do a different thing. And then the federal prisons do something different from the state prisons. So there's no one sort of overarching policy in terms of HIV transmission in prison, other than it is illegal to have sex in prisons, and illegal to have drug paraphernalia or to do tattooing or some of the other ways in which transition may happen. But primarily, you know, sexual contact is what we're talking about. Now, some cities, like in New York City, the jails here in New York City do give condoms. In Philadelphia, they also have a condom distribution campaign in the jails, and also in Los Angeles. And there are probably some other cities that distribute condoms. I think the only other state other than New York State that gives condoms in prisons, I think, is Alabama or Mississippi, one of the two, strangely enough. So there's really no strategy. Now, what's interesting about the prison system and HIV, which goes against a lot of the kind of narratives that people think, is that actually only about, of all the people who have HIV in U.S. prisons, only about 9% of them contracted HIV in the prison. 91% of them came to prison HIV positive. Many find out when they're in prison, because that might be the first time that they've ever been offered an HIV test. And there's much more mounting public health research that's beginning to point to the connection between massive imprisonment and the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the U.S. So if we consider, you know, say New York City, right, which has one of the highest HIV rates in the country, about 10% of all people with HIV live in New York City, right, in the total U.S. And if we look at the neighborhoods in New York City that have the highest HIV rates, and then we also look at the neighborhoods that have the highest incarceration rates, it's almost a one-for-one match, with the exception of Chelsea being the outlier, because that's where white gay men live who are also impacted by the epidemic. So let's take the prison system. So if you look at New York State prisons, 70% of prisoners in New York State come from seven neighborhoods in New York City, right? So, and those are all Black and Latino neighborhoods. And so if you think about that, and think about if you have that a high percentage of people who are constantly being moved in and out of the state prison system, that in and of itself changes the social and sexual networks, changes the social and sexual dynamics of a community, to the extent that people, that it's much easier for the virus to be quickly transmitted along those sexual networks, because people constantly have to change partners because people are constantly being locked up and taken upstate. So there's more public health research that's actually looking at massive imprisonment in the U.S. as an actual driver itself of HIV transmission, and not so much, to a far less extent, sex that may be happening in prisons itself. And there have been some studies that have looked at, even in states like the state of Georgia, you know, which, you know, criminalizes sex between prisoners. There was one study that was done by the CDC, and what they found was that even in that case, most prisoners were still trying to figure out ways to have protected sex. They were using saran wrap, they were trying to use a range of different things, where condoms and other things were not available, or were even contraband, right, were illegal to even possess. So it's not as though people in prison aren't trying to protect themselves. And the other interesting thing about that study was a lot of the sex that was happening, I want to say it was about 30 to 40% of it was with guards and other staff, and was not with other prisoners, right? So there's also a relationship between kind of coercion and, you know, the kind of guards and security within the prisoner, and prisoners themselves who have to then sleep with guards in order to be able to get certain kinds of privileges or a range of things, you know, in that respect. So that's really kind of what the HIV transmission and prison connection is in the U.S., and in many ways it defies what people often think.
Most of the things that you're talking about strike me as being fundamentally determined by class and race backgrounds, correct? How can the LGBT movements be so completely disassociated from this reality of such large portions of the population.
You're absolutely right in the sense that a lot of, yeah, well, what I'm talking about, kind of economic justice issues and kind of mass imprisonment, are so clearly based on kind of race and class, right? And your ability to access material resources, or the likelihood of you, your just body and physical presence is going to be criminalized by the state, completely based on race, class, and even in gender identity to a certain extent, especially if you are, you know, a person of color. And the national, the sort of mainstream equality movement, you know, the LGBT equality movement, isn't really dealing with those issues because they really see that, they think that in order to win the sort of policy agenda that they have set, it means that they're going to have to present the LGBT community as quote unquote normal, as middle America, right? So that means the community in all of its sort of promotion and all of its advocacy and all of the TV shows and sitcoms and all that stuff that exists has to look as white, as middle class, as possible, and as kind of heteronormative as possible, in order to get basically middle class white straight America to say, oh yeah, they're not so bad, they're just like us too. And then that they don't have to, and so the movement isn't interested in challenging kind of larger structures of racism or larger structures of kind of economic deprivation, because it doesn't see any value in that if what it wants to do is to assimilate the few gays and lesbians who can assimilate into, you know, kind of white, middle class, Christian, capitalist patriarchy, as bell hooks once said. If that's your goal, you're not going to then start talking about kind of poverty and wealth redistribution or racial justice work in any way other than in ways that are very tokenized, right?
What is your opinion about the kind of racial segregation debate that happened around Proposition 8 in California? The gays and lesbians claiming that the black population backlashed on the bill by not supporting it. On the other hand, the kind of token representation of black identities in the media to presuppose that it is a unified community, and these other things of this sort.
Yeah, well, what happened in California with Proposition 8 and the kind of backlash against, you know, the black community in California, and really the extended to the U.S., was just a hot mess. I mean, to be quite blunt about it. First of all, the kind of white gay community made several kind of false assumptions about themselves and about what actually happened in Prop 8. The first false assumption was, well, we went out on a limb and voted for Barack Obama, the first, you know, black president, and so we did all this for you, black people, right, was the thinking. And you turned around and stabbed us in the back by voting for Proposition 8. Well, first of all, when you actually look at the electoral data from 2008, white gay voters, gay and lesbian voters, actually voted less for Barack Obama than they did for John Kerry or Al Gore in 2000 and 2004. So there was actually less gay votes for Barack Obama than there were for the previous two Democratic candidates over the 8 years prior. So they didn't quite turn out the gay vote in the numbers for Barack Obama that they suggest. That's number one. Number two is, the first exit polling data from California that suggested that 70% of black people in California voted for Prop 8 turned out to be wrong, because the subsequent data showed that about 57% of black voters voted for Prop 8, which is only slightly higher than all other racial communities. All racial communities were around 50, 52, 53%, right? So it wasn't that the black population was so much of an outlier in that respect. And also the other sort of problems there is that Black people are only 7% of the population in the state of California. So there were just really not enough numbers in the state of California for Black people to actually have a real impact on how that went one way or the other. When you looked at the people who voted for Prop 8, it was really what swung it, you know, in the direction of Prop 8 winning were older voters and voters who were considered themselves to be religious or of faith. There were no attacks against senior citizens or Christians, right, from the gay community, because that's really where the votes were. So there was a range of those false assumptions and also just no ownership of how badly that campaign, the No on 8, the sort of gay, you know, opposition to the bill, how horribly they ran that campaign, both around, you know, not even hiring a person to do work in the Black community in the state of California until 7 days before the election. And that's been documented. And certainly providing not a lot of resources to folks who wanted to do that work. But they also just had no ground game. They tried to run a campaign that was a media campaign without a whole lot of organizing, grassroots organizing on the ground. And they got whooped, right? The money was about the same on both sides. So it wasn't like they got outspent in financial resources. They just, the Yes on 8 people's ground game was better, and they got their asses handed to them. And they have, people still won't take entire ownership over that.
One of the things that was striking to me about these things that you're mentioning and having followed up with what happened there is that it kind of revealed a systemic racism of the country.
Yeah, Prop 8 in many ways, it to me felt like in that moment, like all these like white gays and lesbians who had been wanting to say a lot of stuff to Black people that they have felt ranges of like frustration or their own kind of weird stuff around, it like gave them the opportunity to do it. So like Dan Savage, you know, writing that blog called Black Homophobia, to me seemed like something Dan Savage has been thinking for a long time and, you know, used that opportunity to say, and then all of the things that have rolled out since. I mean, you know, things, names I've been called on the internet by a lot of white gay and lesbian folks who, despite all of the data that I just quoted about Prop 8 and whatever, refuse to actually believe it. Like, refuse to actually believe that the majority, it wasn't some huge majority of Black people who voted for it. Like, their concept is that the Black community is at this point their primary opposition, and that's how they see it. And so there's no, one, just acknowledgement of the different kind of ways in which, like, queer stuff is actually being kind of talked about, debated, discussed in the Black community. Monique, for instance, on her show, I mean, is talking about queer folks, has queer folks on all the time. Whatever, you know what I mean? And that's a really kind of popular show. BET just had me on, just had, you know, this video by this R&B artist, Marsha Ambrosius, you know, which deals very squarely with like homophobic violence in the Black community or whatever that's out and about now. I have not seen GLAAD write about that video. I've not seen, GLAAD hasn't posted like the thing about me being on BET, or even like, there's a range of ways in which like this is
on
not.
BET is the hero award that you got.
Yeah, right? Yeah, which I'm not like, I don't care about
can
like.
Can you just mention briefly what that
sure.
was?
Sure. So I was just recently honored by Black Entertainment Television, BET, here as one of the modern Black history heroes, right, this year. This is the second year that they've done it, and they honor four people a year, and I was one of the four, and I was the, you know, in the 2 years, I was the first queer person that they chose, which was a shock to me, and was also, I mean, was a shock, one, that it just was me. I don't feel like I'm, like, on the national radar like that, but also because there are some kind of more, I feel like, politically safer Black queer folks they could have chosen who work in entertainment, who do a range of different things. But they approached me. I didn't approach them. So that was interesting, right, as a choice. And so far, from what they've told me, from what I've just seen on the internet, so the feedback has been really, really positive. So anyway, so just to say that, like, there's clearly, like, work being done, right, around, like, it's not to say there isn't homophobia in the Black community. It's clearly Black queer folks who are pushing that, and Black straight allies who are pushing different things there. But it's been interesting to me that in the last couple of months, like, these specific sort of instances, like myself and, like I said, this pretty well-known R&B singer, Marsha Ambrosius, whose video is now all over BET, with very clear Black gay couple kissing in the video, very clear, you know, kind of homophobic responses to them in the community, whatever. And I've not seen any of the kind of national organizations, nor GLAAD, nor any of the, like, really kind of respect nor honor me nor her for those different, or BET for, like, making those, that, you know, those advances, I think. So, and that's, I think, because it speaks to the actual, the racism and the, like, this framework that the Black community is just more homophobic forever and ever, amen, and that's it, right? And so any of the work to kind of challenge that is just, like, completely unacknowledged.
One of the ideas that interests me as I've been developing this project is returning to the value of difference as opposed to complying with the promises of equality. How do you respond to difference? Do you find that difference is an interesting political platform to work from, to rescue and to reinstate in the discourse?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that difference in some ways is important, and for people in terms of the political discourse to be thinking about difference and, for lack of a better word, sort of diversity. But I think what we often lose, or what I think the danger is there, is that people will take difference to just mean tokenization, right? So that, like, if I just have a Black person, a Latino, an immigrant, a poor person, a trans person, whatever it is, as the kind of face of something, then that's okay. And it doesn't actually require me to actually think deeply about my politics and my, like, kind of political commitments. And so I think I'm more interested in a debate around, you know, what's really justice and what's the vision for where we're going. And I don't think the LGBT movement has a vision for where it's going. I think it is made some politically, what they thought, I think anyway, were politically expedient choices. But there's no actual vision about what any of these policy sort of choices are and what these campaigns ultimately mean. And I think it's reflected in the fact that now that, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was basically, you know, dropped in some respects, mostly by court order and not by any of the advocacy work that the organizations did. And even a lot of the kind of marriage, work that was done at the state level resulted in, like, 30 different state constitutions so it was like a colossal failure. If you want to really quantify the sort of same-sex marriage movement, it's resulted in actually worse, like, policy for LGBT folks, right? The opposition was that fierce. And I think because of that, there's now a kind of, I don't think the organizations mostly are just swimming in, like, we don't know what to do next. And so I think this is an important place, not for people like myself or organizations like QEJ to offer to the equality organizations a way out, because I think they're just going to co-opt it and do something really poorly, but actually to stand in the gap as, like, actually we have a different political framework, we have a vision and a different strategy for where to go next, and then organize people around that.